We lived in tents for a little while we were building our own house. Then I also have autism, dyslexia, synesthesia, and savant. And so that was really difficult. Then built and sold 12 companies, won 4 private equity awards for transactions between 250 million and a billion.
Well, it absolutely does. And I want to say, firstly, this doesn't want to come across patronizing, but thank you very much for your bravery of communicating it. You know, we all have demons. We all have things that were, you know, that have happened to us or that we grew up with or we were born with that we're not proud of. Welcome back, everybody, to the Raw Selection Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is an extra special one with Gregory Shepherd, entrepreneur of 14 companies, author and founder of Boss Capital Partners, a firm investing in lower middle market technology companies globally. This is a special one. Greg humbly shares his very humble background and his upbringing, growing up in a tent, to then progressing to everything we've just shared, but also his neurodivergencies and the things that most people would foresee as holding him back that is actually he regards as his superpowers, which has allowed him to come on and achieve all the things that he's about to tell us about. So this is a big one and a massive cracker. Thanks a lot for coming on the Private Equity Podcast, Gregory, and sharing everything you have done and all of those potential things that we wouldn't have shared and we wouldn't have gone through as most people, throwing it out there to inspire others. So here it is on the Private Equity Podcast, Gregory Shepherd. Gregory, as is customary, if you could give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please.
Sure. I grew up in a family of foster and adopted kids, and I grew up poor. We lived in tents for a little while we were building our own house. Then I also have autism, dyslexia, synesthesia, and savant. And so that was really difficult. I then built and sold 12 companies, won 4 private equity awards for transactions between 250 million and a billion, sold 2 companies to eBay, became the chief strategy officer for eBay Enterprise, and then the chief technology officer, and did a transaction where we bought all of the eBay Enterprise companies and then sold some and merged some together and rebuilt that, went into politics during Barack Obama, trying to get women and people of color into Congress. Then left that and then started Startup Science, which is the business I have now, based on a research project I did on why, when, and how founders fail, and then wrote a book about that that's getting published on September 24th. And that I did a TED Talk also, you know, written a few hundred articles, you know, you get the idea.
So No, that's beautiful. So from humble beginnings, living in a tent, that's quite a story. Obviously, some what people would see as disadvantages, but I'm sure you will explore later as advantages. What inspired you down the investor route? What inspired you down the private equity route to be therefore obviously winning awards?
I became really good as a, you know, those are all companies I started myself and sold. So I became really good at, 12, which is pretty good, and never lost one. So I built, sold 12, you know. And then I learned about founders, and I learned about what to look for, and I learned about, you know, from the founder's perspective. Then I started investing in the companies. And when I started to invest in the companies, I started to see not only how to choose a deal based on the founder, but also how to look at the progress of the deal, because you're always looking for probability and predictability. So looking at probability and predictability based on my insights into what it takes to actually build and sell a company. So it gave me a unique perspective that I carry today, which is like this investor side of me and also a founder side of me.
Well, this is going to be a fascinating conversation, Gregory. I've already got about 1,000 questions that I could ask you just off that opening statement, but we'll go with our usual second question to begin with. What one mistake do you see private equity firms or portfolio companies making, and what actions would you suggest to correct them?
I think I've seen this. I mean, if you look at what happened during the last downturn, what you saw is an overvaluation issue. And overvaluation always comes up and catches on you. So what you see is from the founder's perspective and from the industry, from the LP perspective, you look at it and you say, okay, these bankers and the private equity and VCs and so on, it looks like what they're doing is raising the valuation of the company so they can raise the valuation of their portfolio, so they can raise more money so that they can get more of the 2 and 20 that they get typically on a deal, right? So from that perspective, that's something that needs to be corrected. In other words, raising the valuation isn't good for the founder, and it's also not good for the investors, the LPs themselves. So I think one thing is to pay attention to what companies are actually worth versus what you can get financed, right? Just because you can get a round in doesn't mean it's actually worth that, right? And that's what we saw happen with Tiger Global dropping 50% and stuff, right? So that's one thing. The other thing is that, we keep experiencing the same thing over the dot bomb. When that happened, it was all this hype and everything about all these companies coming out on the internet that had no real numbers. And then boom, reality comes around. And this has happened again, So, you see this hype. So, real businesses with real revenue models, with real revenue, with real customers and real acquisition partners lined up matters. And making sure that you understand, instead of from an investor perspective driving the bus looking at financials, where are the financials coming from? Because financials are a lagging indicator. There's a lot of latency. You do something as a founder that doesn't hit the financials for a year. So if you're an investor and you're looking at the financials, it's like driving a car looking behind you the whole time. Instead, look at what's creating the financials, and then the financials come. The money that you see on the financials are an outcome. They're not the goal. The founders need to be focusing on what creates those numbers. And so the investors should also be focused on what creates those numbers instead of just the numbers. Otherwise, you can reverse it. If you're looking at what creates the numbers, it's like being a time machine. You're going backwards to look at what the future is going to look like. But if you base it on the financials, you're going backwards in time instead of forwards. And so you're always going to be behind. So I think that those are some of the things that I see them making over and over, year after year, decade after decade. It's the same exact formula. And that causes the 90% failure rate in founders, typically 57.1% in the first 18 months. And then you see the rest of the remaining 5 years in the study that they failed. The majority of the things they fail for after the first 18 months are things they did in the first 18 months. And all of that comes down to the biggest reasons are one of the biggest ones is overvaluation, which is what I spoke about earlier.
Seems simple, doesn't it? Real customers, real revenues, real profits, genuine EBITDAs, not EBITDAs before COVID, or adjusted out to hell. What? So you mentioned you've written a book, and remind me of the title about the
It's
founder.
the Startup Life Cycle by Gregory Shepard. It's published by Ben Bella on September 24th. Thanks for letting me plug that. I appreciate it.
And you mentioned that kind of gives you an indication, or you've written about the fact that you know what a good founder looks like, and you've included that. What from your perspective, this is what makes up a good founder? How do you know?
There's different aspects to it, right? So the thing that I've noticed is you see a good idea with a bad founder, you see a bad idea with a good founder, right? The idea is a really important part of the concept. But if the founder that you're working with can't execute, meaning they don't have time management, organization, the soft skills, and the work ethic, just plain old grinding, right, to get it done, then you're going to have issues. And that's why one of the reasons why we've at startupscience.io, the platform, because they can go in and they can take classes, and then the investors can watch them and they can see how they're answering the questions and what they're learning and build a profile so they can sort of judge that founder. The idea of building that was the idea of providing the founders with the format and then giving the investors the data. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Absolutely does. Thank you very much. You mentioned that, well, your website mentions that you're very hands-on with your portfolio. It mentions something called the proprietary BOSS operating support system. Sure, you're not going to tell us exactly what that is, as proprietary does give us an indication. It's some kind of yours and yours only. But what are you doing differently with your portfolio based on your knowledge of starting, you know, 10 plus companies and being successful with all those 10 that you've been implementing in order to increase the success and exit potential of your portfolio businesses?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is what I told you earlier is using leading KPIs. So when you think about KPIs, key performance indicators, you have expense KPIs and you have income KPIs, just like you have expense and income on your P&L, right? Your profit and loss. So you have both of those drivers that affect those two areas of the that. And then in addition to that, you have leading and lagging. So you can have expense indicator that is leading or an expense indicator that is lagging. Typically, if it's a if it's an end result, it's lagging, right? Because it's done, you can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Versus leading means you can do something about the future by acting on it now. So the big thing that I've done in my portfolio is managing to the future, not managing to the present. So focusing on what I can do to change what's happening instead of focusing on what's happening always from the very, very beginning, right? And so out of all of my investments, I've only lost one so far, and that was because of COVID. It literally shut it down. But you know, that's the one of the main drivers that I tell people. I'm like, you need to pay attention to the business, just like you pay it. If you're in the stock market and you're looking at what's going on with your stocks in the stock market and you're trading on that data, it's similar to your portfolio companies. I mean, those are your stocks and you have data. So you need to use that data to understand the way the business is moving so you can understand whether you should double down or, you know, pull the parachute or whatever you need to do to try to make sure that those things have the upside potential and the downside risk floor considered as you move forward way before it's too late. Like if you look at what happened here, you know, post COVID and you saw this huge spike and then this huge crash, it was like, it felt like it was all of a sudden, but it wasn't all of a sudden. The signs were there for a really, really, really long time. And everybody was getting stuff from PitchBook and Crunchbase and, you know, unicorns and high deal values and everybody getting rounds of funding. I mean, if that isn't alarms going off, I don't know what is, right? Like, how is that possible? How are you seeing companies with $1 billion valuations with nowhere near the revenue to justify that? So that's one thing. The other thing I do is I pay attention to the businesses based on their valuation drivers. So these are things that increase valuation, growth, margin, and retention. It's always the same, growth, margin, and retention, right? What should those numbers be? Where is the portfolio company at? And how do I ensure that they can, that they're focused on those, right? And what I mean by that is the functional areas should be attached to the valuation drivers, growth, sales, and marketing, right? Service and support, retention. And operations and shared services, that's margin, right? So you put the numbers on the functional areas, you make them accountable to those numbers, and now you have a connection inside the business to those drivers. That's transparent to both the investor and to the functional area leaders. Not to the founder, to the functional area leaders, the people that are actually at the computer doing those jobs. Those two things, I mean, I can't even tell you how drastically that changes the way that you can manage your deals. It's just substantially different.
Sorry to interrupt. Just a quick mention of our long-standing partnership with Grata. As you will probably know, the private equity scene is constantly evolving. And deal flow is moving now to proprietary and data-driven processes. Grata provides you with the data and information of over 7 million private companies. So if you're looking to improve your proprietary deal flow and improve the data access, then reach out to Grata today. Now back to the podcast. And if we think as a good investor, we create what's commonly termed in private equity as playbooks. Mm-hmm. We then put those playbooks into our portfolio companies and we educate our leaders. Are you working with each of your portfolio executives to understand the models that you're creating, understanding leading lagging indicators, which are commonly talked about on the podcast, but aren't commonly used in business? Is this something that you're like, if you've got a playbook that you're then deploying into each portfolio company, educating these executives? I'm assuming you're not holding it all at private equity investor level and keeping the keys to the castle and looking at the figures and telling them what to do.
Yeah, and also to your point earlier about BOSS, which just stands for the Business Operating Support System, I started a platform called StartupScience.io, and it educates the founders. And I started building that. I was sitting there having to do it one-to-one, and you can't scale that way. You have to do one-to-many. So when I learned about the common reasons why founders fail, I built a platform that educates them on how not to fail for those reasons. And now that platform is all over, Fulbright adopted it as their platform. We've got Harvard and Stanford and Oxford and all these universities using it to manage their deal flow. So they're actually using it to offset the issues that I initially set out to offset in investing in portfolio companies.
Perfect. Yeah. And that education through to the portfolio, creating playbooks, giving them the information, letting them deploy. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you just assign them. You just go to the founder and you're like, take this course, right? You're looking at their numbers and you're like, your CAC to LTV is 2. Go take this course so you understand what it is. And then let's talk about it, right? Because these founders oftentimes don't understand what questions to ask, what questions they're being asked, let alone the answers. So you have to educate them and level them up to a certain point before you can get the data that you need to figure out how to get the company back on track.
Which what I love about that is it's basically a training program for executives. Now, there's a lot of private equity firms out there, but like, yeah, okay, we're talking about founders. We're not talking about proven CEOs. But if we're educating and we're bringing chief executives into your private equity portfolio companies and you're not giving them the tools that you want them to deploy and how you want to operate, it would be a good idea to create these kind of programs, even if some of them are fairly simplistic. How do you deal? How do you, what information do you want on a regular basis? How do they produce that, et cetera, and creating something exceptional? Then I think that's a good lesson for any private equity firm to begin to deploy inside their private equity firm to deploy out to their portfolio.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about this, right, if you talk to founders, and I've talked to thousands of them, and you ask them what went wrong, and they go, well, if I had known, I didn't know. Like, that's what you hear all the time, right?
Yep.
You hear them saying, if I had known, I didn't know. So those are the things that you have to teach them. Because when you look at the data on why founders fail, why, when, and how they fail, what you see is you see that the majority of them are failing for the same reasons over and over and over and over again, right? So it's like, that's Einstein's definition of insanity is doing the same thing over, expecting different results. So it's insane. So what do you do? Well, you teach them about the things that people are failing for over and over again to prevent it from happening in the first place, right? So that's a big pointer. I tell VCs, I'm like, listen, get a version of this platform and start assigning your founders to things that are happening in there. Like, hey, what's CAC to LTV? Here's an 8-minute micro course on it that explains exactly what it is. Now have a conversation with the PE. So it changes the dynamics in terms of the founder being able to have a logical conversation. And a lot of times, what's really interesting is that, when you look at the data, the first reason why they fail the majority of the time is from bad decisions. And the bad decisions comes from bad advice, like an iceberg, right? So it goes down to bad advice. Well, who's giving the bad advice? Guess what number one is? Investors.
Oh, really?
Number one, investors. Number two, consultants, then mentors, program managers. It's all the people that are supposed to be helping them. They listen to them and they say what they're saying is Bible. So they go out and they do what they tell them to do. So then you break it down, right? So then I did the research even more and I said, how many program managers have ever been founders? I mean, it's not even 1%. So then I'm like, how many investors have ever been founders? Not even close to 1%. So these are the people that are telling a founder who's actually in the trenches building a company what to do. Of course, they're going to give them bad advice. So they're hurting their own selves. So a lot of times we tell them, take the classes yourself so that you understand what you're doing before you give advice to the founders.
Thanks. Makes perfect sense. So in your intro and in your bio, again, on your website, you talk openly about your neurodivergencies. Mm-hmm. Now, part of my question was going to be if you're comfortable to share, which you've already opened with it. If you can tell us a little bit about this, because it's a particular topic that I think is poignant both within our firm, outside any organization that, you know, has got people who perceive to be hindered but could actually be aided by the success. And you've been great with sharing that. So how has your neurodivergences hindered you, but also how has it aided your success?
So let's define neurodivergent. It just means different brain. That neurodivergent is neuro's brain and divergent is different, right? So it means different brain. So when we talk about the advantages are we have a different brain. So if the majority of the people are thinking one way and we're thinking a different way, you already have an advantage, right? Just right there. The second thing is that we have, it depends on we call them superpowers in our world. We call them superpowers, and we call regular people, we call them normies. So if you have a neurodivergent condition, and neurodivergent is a big word for a lot of different things. Autism is seven of those things, but you have to have all seven to be autistic. And then savant is where you have a really one thing that's really, really powerful. Like if you ever seen Rain Man, or any of those movies, you know, sometimes it's counting, sometimes it's math, sometimes it's patterns, mine's patterns. And you have these things that you're just off the charts in terms of your ability to comprehend and come to conclusions. So in my situation, dyslexia has been extremely difficult. That has hindered and still does. I read at like a fourth grade level when I look at words and things, that everything's moving around all the time. So it's like trying to read a book while you're on a roller coaster, I guess. So I have special tools for that in apps in my computer and my phone. I even have a pen that I drag across menus so it reads to my headphones. That has been a extremely difficult thing, especially when writing a book. And, you know, writing articles and all this kind of stuff is extremely difficult. But it comes with a lot of other benefits, right? Which is where, because my brain is working different, it sees things in a different way. There's a picture of my brain on my website. And you can see a normal brain and a scan, and then you can see my brain. And you can see that a normal brain, there's this big blue part and a small pink part. And you think, see, in my brain, the pink part is all over the whole brain and the blue part is smaller. Right. These pictures are taken as you're looking at different pictures or thinking about things. So they'll tell you, think about this, look at this, and then they watch your brain activity. It shows this drastic, it's like two completely different brains, you know, the way that they operate. So I think that the advantages have been really, really big, but there are disadvantages. I have a hard time walking through an airport. I can't go to a concert or a fair or anything with a lot of lights or a lot of big sounds or a lot of people, things like that are can be very difficult for me. You know, I have to mask all the time. So there's this thing in our world called masking, which is hiding what's happening inside. And there's things called camouflage, which is becoming what's around you, like what I'm doing now with you, and then mirroring, which is where you act just like the other person. So these are tools that we use to to look normal, I guess. But what's happening on the inside is a whole lot more. So I may be calmly talking to you underneath the table. I'm working a fidget and my brain is going, you know, crazy, right? So there's a lot of things going on, not just the conversation, but also a lot of other things branching off and creating thought patterns and running algorithms. So I think that it's got a lot of really big benefits and I like to focus on those. But the growing up with it was awful, you know, I got beat up like every day, sometimes twice or three times a day, called some pretty names that I can't even use right now because they're not even politically correct. And barely graduated from high school, you know, but then I've won 4 private equity awards for transactions to $1 billion. And, you know, so it's like on one side, it's like some of the academic things are really hard for me, but my superpowers are pretty, you know, pretty good. So I think that, you know, the other thing I think is really important I was going to say is that 25% of founders are neurodivergent in some way. It says
What?
something, right? It says something that a founder can find the gaps in between things. That requires, in some cases, neurodivergence, right? A different way of thinking. So, you know, I don't want to talk about that too much on the whole podcast, but I think that kind of gives you an answer to your question.
Well, it absolutely does, and I want to say, firstly, this doesn't want to come across patronizing, but thank you very much for your bravery of communicating it. You know, we all have demons, we all have things that were, you know, that have happened to us, or that we grew up with, or we were born with that we're not proud of, or that we should be. We should speak out, and has that happened to us, or is part of us? And you know, to say that on the podcast to thousands and thousands of people in private equity, and then jumping in as well, exactly that you managed to get four awards for exit from for M&A deals is just phenomenal, and just shows, you know, anybody listening that has any of them, you know, to embrace that, but also, you know, it doesn't hold you back, and you've found tools to manage that, and you've achieved a lot in private equity. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that haven't won any awards. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that haven't set up 12 businesses and been successful. And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that don't have a large portfolio of companies as an investor and working with them, as well as all the other things that you have, speaker, and everything else, author that you have under your banner. So, you know, thanks for being open with that and inspiring others to embrace what they see as their downfalls, but you see as their superpowers. And
Yeah, I mean,
that's
you know,
great.
if you look, like Nikola Tesla was autistic, Einstein was autistic, neurodivergent people include Elon Musk, Richard Branson, Steve Jobs. I mean, you know, these I used to hide it, but then I started to see all this stuff and I'm like, wait a minute. I don't need to hide this. I can actually wear it as a badge of honor, you know? So, yeah, thank you for saying that such kind things. I appreciate it.
Not only am I the host of the Private Equity Podcast, but I'm also the founder and managing partner of Raw Selection. Raw Selection is a private equity specialist executive search firm with two divisions, one that focuses on portfolio, C-suite executive hires, and one that focuses on private equity direct hires of your back office and investment deal professionals to the industry. Alongside the podcast, we're passionate about giving back to the industry and giving people information that they can run and utilize. One thing we do regularly every year is we run SALI reports on accurate and live data of people that we've interviewed and people that have shared their information with us. So if you're looking to compare your current compensation or your compensation for your next hire in your private equity firm or portfolio company, then please check out our YouTube channel and see the playlist of salary surveys. So another thing that's on your website, you see I've done a fair bit of research into Gregory, is your altruistic capitalism. So if you can give us a definition of what you perceive as altruistic capitalism, and then tell us what you're actually doing and what it means with regards to your execution on it.
Yeah, I wrote this article for Forbes, and my concept was that if you use the power of capitalism for altruistic outcomes, then you have a blend of the perfect thing. It's the synergy of these things that make it really effective. So, as an example, use the power of capitalism to clean up environmental issues, sustainability issues, inclusion issues, so on and so forth, right? If you use the power of capitalism, in other words, make it profitable to motivate people to do things that matter, right? Then you have the wind at your back, right? You have this tailwind sort of pushing you forward. So a lot of times people talk about headwinds and tailwinds, and to me, I think about it in terms of where you turn your sail. If you turn it in the right direction, if you're somebody that sails, you can get motion from any direction, unless it's completely dead, right? Which is never the case in business. So, you know, when I think about altruistic capitalism, I think about turning your sails into the wind, right? What is the wind? Well, right now, what is the biggest, most important thing that we have? What is the biggest opportunity in our entire planet? It's industrial transformation. So think about this, right? The Industrial Revolution, think about what that did. It changed the world. It was huge. That's happening again right now. So the transformation of industry to sustainable and environmental things, because we need to all live on this little marble that we're all in this together on, is going to make the internet and everything else look tiny. And that's what's happening right now. I mean, we're talking about every single thing that attaches to industrial from transportation, logistics, manufacturing, energy. It's all attached to this. That's all on the table right now. That's an example of altruistic capitalism.
I had a really interesting story actually that in London, the because obviously everyone was horse-drawn carts, they banned anybody leaving horse poo knocking around. Obviously, nobody listened, nobody did anything about it. And the thing that changed that was Henry Ford and modernizing, and obviously the car, and then everyone eventually drove, and nobody's wandering around on horses or limited with regards to that. And this the guy spoke of, I think it was Jimmy Carr on one of the Joe Rogan podcasts or something like that, and he was speaking about the fact that legislation will come in, legislation will chase, but technology and innovation is what will change the world. And we can legislate, but actually what we need is to innovate and bring technology in to make the changes that we need to happen. It doesn't mean we all just sack it off and stop recycling and wait till, X, Y, and Z happens. But it was just really interesting that the fact that legislation had happened, and we can go back even, hundreds of years and seeing that. And that mirrors exactly what we're talking about with
Innovation
altruistic
leads
capitalism.
legislation. Like that's a really like think about right now, right? Innovation leads legislation, right? So innovation in Tesla that really put electric cars on the map started, then they started passing legislation. Think about the internet and online payments and everything that has to do with privacy. The innovation created the legislation. So legislation is not first. Innovation is first. Legislation takes its lead from innovation. So innovation then is more important than anything. Right? It is the driver for the changes in the world. And where does innovation come from? It comes from our industry. That's where it comes from.
Comes from investors, comes from venture capital firms, comes from private equity firms backing, obviously private wealth, et cetera. But this is why it's such a phenomenal industry to create. And people like you creating 12 different businesses in your spare time whilst investing, authoring, writing a book, and doing everything else you've done, even with your neurodivergences, which we now reference as your superpowers. So, Gregory, what are your influences? You said you've obviously got dyslexia, so I'm guessing reading, maybe audiobooks we'd recommend, but what do you watch? What do you listen to that you would recommend that others should check out?
I'm a data fiend. Like, I don't even watch TV unless I can learn something. So if I'm watching TV, I'm watching a documentary or something like that, and I go through 4 or 5 audiobooks in any given month. I listen to every audiobook that comes out in our industry, and even some of the more theory kind of books like Sapiens and Homo Genius and things like that, factual. A lot of books that have like real data in them instead of just hype, and people that are talking about things that have, that are real instead of like, I have this idea. I'm like, hey, it's fine if you have an idea, but show me the data or talk about the data that you have that you built the idea off of so I can follow you and see if I agree with your concepts, right? So, a lot of audiobooks, I sign up for hundreds of newsletters. And I have them all filter into a folder, and then it's called to review. And then at the end of the month, I go through all of them,
Wow.
and I have the machine read them all to me, and then I make notes on the side as the machine's reading them to me, so I can keep up with stuff. I think that those things are really important. I think the political climate is also important. Like we have this whole situation with Japan, and we have this whole situation with Israel. We have this whole situation with Ukraine. There are tells in there about what is to come, right? So you look at the Ukraine, every time there is a war, there is opportunity to rebuild what was there before, right? Every time there is a war, there are new innovations on how to do war in a way where there's less collateral damage, et cetera, et cetera. Every time there's a natural disaster. So opportunity follows a lot of these, the fire burns down and then it turns into fertilizer and new growth happens, right? So I pay attention to that stuff so I can see ahead of what's happening. I think of disruptions like a still pond, and then you throw a stone in the pond and you get that first sort of wake that comes on the outside of that pond. To me, that's the the opportunity is small. It's close to the core of the disruption, but it's very small. The farther out it gets, the more opportunities are there. So if you think about it, when the internet came out and everything, one of the big drops off of that circle was the iPhone. But the iPhone itself produced less opportunities than the things on the iPhone.
That's true.
Right? So all of the apps that you see and all the social media that you see and the music that you see, I mean, everything, right? Those things are the outer circle. The iPhone was a drop in the center. So I pay attention not to the disruption, because I'm always interested in inch wide, mile deep, right? So if you're looking at things that are a mile wide, like AI right now, or deep tech used to be, or analytics, or e-commerce, some of the e-commerce technology, you know, all those things, right? What that means is that there's so many people seeing this opportunity. The opportunity gets shallow because it starts to fill up. So it starts to fill up, go wide, because it starts to fill up with competitors that are building that. What I look for are inch wide, mile deep. Everything people are jumping over, but has a lot of potential. And that you can get from looking at that arena, you know, that disruption cycle, and also what's going on in environmental and politics.
It's fascinating. I've never even thought of it like that. And looking at the ripple effect and seeing how it all plays out. If anybody wants to reach out to you, Gregory, there's a lot of topics, no doubt, that we could have talked about in this podcast. There's a lot of things that you've mentioned that I would have 1,000 questions on. We could be here for hours. How best do they reach out to you, please?
My website is gregoryshepherd.com. Startupscience.io is the website for the software that we build to help founders. And then Boss Capital Partners is the website for investing. And then I'm in LinkedIn, and I mean, if they Google my name, I'm all over the place, but sure. Yeah. So I really appreciate you letting me talk about that and all the other stuff. And I want to show a tremendous amount of respect for you and what you're doing, and also humility for all the people that listen to your podcast. You know, my mom used to say, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And I think I'm in the right room, so I'm definitely not the smartest person in the room. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for yours. Thank you for sharing everything you've got, everything you've done, all of your achievements, what some people would perceive as clear, well, what everyone would see as clearly humble beginnings, growing up, potentially living in it or living in a tent at one point, to then obviously having all these neurodivergencies, turning them into superpowers and paving a way for anybody can achieve anything. So clearly an inspiration. So, you know, thank you very much for coming on. Thanks for being so open with regards to everything that's gone on in your life and giving us a brief insight into the world of Gregory Shepherd.
Namaste, my friend.
And as always, everybody who's listening to the Private Equity Podcast today, thank you very much for tuning in. Should you ever need support with hiring private equity professionals or, of course, portfolio executives, please do reach out to us here at Raw Selection. But till the next time, keep smashing it. And thank you very much for listening.